From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in just about every American city, in delivery rooms everywhere, and we have the stories every single day, week, and month of the year of young mothers and children and the desire to get those children off to good starts. And unfortunately, in cities across the country, whether it's Rochester or Geneva, Syracuse, Buffalo, Chicago, New York, wherever it is, you have children being born in sometimes difficult circumstances, sometimes young mothers with their first child struggling in some ways, and we have very high numbers of preventable deaths. That's what the medical community will call those. We're talking about deaths to homicide or drugs or injury or illness. And the question becomes, how do you prevent that? How do you improve the outcomes for these mothers, their children, the first 2 years of their lives when it's so crucial to development? We've been looking at NFPs, Nurse Family Partnership. It's a program that seeks to intervene and help. And the question is it working? And we're finally able to talk more broadly about just how much it is working. I want to welcome a couple of guests who can help us understand the news this week that had so many people excited. Dawn Borgeist is the Senior Vice President of United Way of Greater Rochester, which is so heavily involved in NFP. Dawn, nice to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Dr. Harriet Kitzman is with the University of Rochester Medical Center, the Senior Associate Dean for Research for the School of Nursing, involved with this study as well. And Dr. Kitzman, thank you, first of all, for taking the time to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This was a wide and long study, wasn't it?
It has been a long study. We have been following the mothers and children that we initially worked with for 20 years. So during that period of time, we've been able to understand what they have done individually, how they have shaped their lives, and how they're performing now 20 years later.
20 years, and do we, can you give me a quick ballpark on how many families we're talking about?
We're talking about over 1,100. Altogether, and that was the 1138 was the number for this particular study.
And we're talking, so in research terms, it's a healthy sample size.
It is a very healthy sample size. It's a size that allows us to have confidence in the findings and findings that then we feel quite confident in going out from a point of view of policy.
Now, I would ask either one of you to help us understand what NFPs are. We mentioned Nurse Family Partnership, the program. What is NFP? We'll start with Dr. Kitzman.
I would be happy to share that with you. It's been an exciting program, both to develop and see its development over time, both in the U.S. as well as abroad. It is essentially to take the challenge of how to help young women having their first children through a healthy pregnancy and also a healthy child for the first 2 years of life. But more importantly, it's a very important time and transition for the mother. She's moving from a non-mother to a mother, and she's taking on many new challenges, many new roles, and this essentially sets the stage for her life trajectory in terms of her own health, her relationships, and what she wants in terms of a life for herself.
Give me a snapshot of what a typical NFP program would do for those kinds of mothers.
Well, it starts with the whole question of what does a mother want for herself? What is it that she's hoping for in terms of her own life? We know that mothers, by and large, by the time that they make the decision to retain a pregnancy, go through with the pregnancy, really want the very best for their children as well as themselves and their families. So by and large, it's taking the mother from where she is, what she wants to do, what she wants to learn, and giving her the skills, the competency, and more importantly, the attitudes and excitement about being a parent and about caring for her child, and the excitement of seeing the child develop in important ways.
But, you know, some people hear that and say, absolutely, mothers want the best for them, but that's no different than moms anywhere in this country. And so what makes NFP different?
What makes NFP different is probably the relationship to start with, the relationship that the mother has with the nurse in relationship to the rest of her family, in that the nurse is there to help her figure out, so to speak, what it is that she can do to provide the best care for herself during pregnancy, as well as for her child, and to coach her through the general challenges of day-to-day life as she sets about trying to set her own goals for employment, relationships, marriages, etc.
And so, Dr. Kitzman, what have we seen from this study? How impactful is NFP? What is the difference that it's making?
At 20 years now, we are looking across a full range of function for the mother as well as for all children within the family. We are reporting today just on the deaths because we recognize as a result of a very rigorous examination of National Death Index records that, yes, in reality, there are fewer deaths in mothers 20 years later, fewer deaths in mothers who have been cared for with nurses through the NFP program. And we also know that there are fewer child deaths that are preventable. And with that, I'm talking about accidents, injuries, violence, homicides, and so on. But this is the kind of 20-year. It's very consistent, however, with the findings in early years. For example, at 2 years, we know that mothers cared for their children in different ways so that we had fewer injuries and ingestions then. The children were performing better. The mothers were providing different kind of caregiving. The mothers were able to be more self-reliant. They had established more long-term relationships with their partners, and with that had set themselves up in a position where they could care for their children over a long period of time. And each time, as we have gone through at 4, 6, 9, and 12, we have seen then improvements in the children as well as in the mothers, mothers being more self-sufficient with less impairment from alcohol use and so on, and more and longer relationships with their partners. There's also, from the point of view of children, seen improved performance, educational performance, and less behavioral problems in terms of internalizing, externalizing behaviors. So the finding today that we are reporting in terms of reduction in deaths is really quite consistent with all the earlier findings, and it really suggests that something very important happens during this pregnancy in the first 2 years to help the mother set herself up for caring for the child and for her family over a long period of time. From the point of view of her own health, how we have delayed chronic illness and death is not known at this point in time, but we know that there are fewer deaths in the mothers who are cared for by the nurses.
If preventable deaths in children was the only thing that was impacted, it would still be a great success. And yet you're talking about life outcomes across the board.
That is the most exciting thing. It's not only the impact on the child and the in terms of the child deaths at the end of childhood, but we can also anticipate, given the rest of the information, we can anticipate a much higher level of function for the child or for the adult child who becomes an adult and improved health over time. And if that comes through, the savings are tremendous. It's a savings in human capital primarily, but it's also a savings in real dollars as we talk about it.
Yeah, we'll get into that in just a minute when it comes to health care and all kinds of other costs that many of us bear out. But remind us again, if you could, what is the how sharply did we see preventable deaths change? I mean, I don't know if you have the figure offhand, but what was the change?
Yes, it was about 3 times the reduction.
Wow.
And so it's highly significant. And And as I said, with the way in which we obtained the data through the National Death Index as well as through our own self-report, we feel quite confident in the findings from findings at this point.
And so on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, how much extra time or home time or whatever that nurse is doing is going on for the NFP, for the Nurse Family Partnership?
In terms of the first 2 years of life?
Yeah, yeah. And during the, I guess, during pregnancy?
During the pregnancy, there's a schedule for the nurse and the mother to visit that changes a little bit from the point of view of what the mother needs. But by and large, it's weekly for 3 or 4 weeks while they get to know one another. It's every other week for the remainder of pregnancy. And then a little more frequently immediately after birth when the infant is more vulnerable and there's more for the mother to grasp. And then from there, every other week for 2 years.
Let me bring in Dawn from the United Way. I imagine the study results do not surprise you in the least.
They do not, although we're always thrilled to have
to get that concrete
that validation.
Number.
Yeah, it's absolutely exciting. And yeah. It's, I think, while we have been specifically funding Monroe County's program. So we serve about 330 young moms in Monroe County today. Our hope and dream is that we will be able to serve all those that are in need. That's probably easily double that number could be served today. And when you see these kind of results, I think it gives us a great inspiration to figure out how we continue to fund more of these. But yeah, we're thrilled with the results because we knew that it helped children. That was one of the reasons United Way turned to NFP. Is we were looking for a proven solution for kids and young women who are in deep poverty, many challenges. And frankly, we were looking for ways to address things like child abuse and young children arriving at kindergarten ready to learn. Those are all benefits that come from this program. Now, this study says not only are we helping that young child, but helping a very young woman really literally transform her life in ways that we couldn't imagine.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time right now. We see this year, in the last 6 months, I've seen more attention than I've ever seen on pre-K, early intervention, things like that. This seems to fall right in line with that.
Absolutely.
And so I want to talk about who is eligible for NFP and how some of this works, because you've got 330 mothers now. Certainly there are more families and moms who
absolutely
need it. We know that.
Yes.
Who's eligible and how do they get the help?
I'm going to turn to Dr. Kitzman for the criteria. It has to be first-time mom.
First-time right? mother. Okay.
In poverty.
That's right.
What other?
And education, reduced education. So it's a combination of those, which makes the mother result in, generally speaking, the mother having fewer resources.
And forgive me, do they have to reach out to NFP? Does NFP have an awareness of who?
Usually the referrals through clinics.
Referrals
so
through
mom
clinics.
Arrives
okay.
pregnant right. at a clinic, and those okay. clinics know about this program.
They know, and they're saying, look, this may be
this
a candidate
be a
for some
help,
et cetera, et cetera. And that's how you know there's so many more who need the help.
Absolutely.
And so going forward here, Dawn, what's a game plan for broadening the program? It has to start with dollars, I imagine.
It has to start with dollars. It also, we will need to increase the workforce in terms of nurses, because you do need trained nurses who can administer this program. We actually are looking at a broad base of, we actually have three home visitation programs, NFP. We took some of the best practices of NFP and combined them to create Building Healthy Children. That's in partnership with Monroe County. You can, for example, NFP is for first-time moms. There are some very young women who are having their second pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So we were just published in the Journal of Pediatrics in January with the first evaluation of that program, which is extremely promising. And then we have parents as teachers. So our goal is, we have been leading a community group that includes the University of Rochester and a number of other organizations and community leaders. And our hope is to gain more resources to really use this as a model in the state for how you use home visitation to advance some of the most critical issues in a community.
Do you have a target? Or is there a number, a formula, a cost per parent, per family that says, for every mom, we're going to need this? And if someone is giving to United Way, can they be very specific about what program they would like to support, et cetera?
They can be very specific. They certainly on our Gathering to Give web-based platform, they can go in and be very specific about that. I can tell you, I don't have off the top what the cost is, but I can tell you that the return on investment is for every dollar that we invest in that program, the return is $6. I don't know of many places you can invest that kind of money in today's marketplace, so to speak, and never mind that we're talking about humanity here. So a great return on investment for what the kinds of issues that you can really help address.
Yeah, we've had Jeff Kazarowski from the Children's Agenda talking about and Carolyn Davis and others from the Children's Agenda talking about ROI. And, you know, sometimes it seems a little clinical and sometimes cold to talk about ROI when it comes to charitable giving. But at the same time, if you can then make a case to people considering giving and saying, we can document it, 6-to-1, or, you know, with pre-K, there's talk that it's between 4 and 7-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
Later in life, there's less incarceration, there's the better health outcomes, less cost to taxpayers in those ways. Isn't that more compelling? Isn't that so much more compelling now to start to be able to flesh some of those numbers out, Dawn?
And I think beyond the numbers, what it says, Evan, is to me what's equally important is when you have limited resources in a community and you've got the kind of desperate problems that we have, you have got to be certain that what you're doing is working. So when we can look at a program like NFP and say that we know with a great level of certainty and confidence that when we invest money and time and human capital, we're gonna turn lives around, it just becomes a win-win for everyone.
For these mothers, again, first-time mothers, probably a lot of them are very young mothers. They may be scared. A lot of the basic starting point of stopping preventable deaths, let alone better life outcomes, probably comes from either bad choices, bad environment around them, being scared of or not knowing how to handle illness at times, those kind of things. My guess, doctor, is that there's all kinds of factors that come in for young mothers who just have never been there before.
There are absolutely numerous factors, and it's a matter of many times structuring the environment as well as structuring the time and the resources for the mother. But as important as that, figuring out helping the mother figure out ways to identify the cues and develop relationships with the child, so that yes, it is easier then for her to create an environment that's specific to that child. I think we're increasingly, the literature is abound now with greater understanding of what the long-term impact is of really a healthy environment for these children. It lasts a lifetime, and many of our data now in terms of cost and benefit are for too short a period of time. But if we're really talking about generations, we can think of it quite differently.
And yet there are comments like this, and I'm trying to scribble as fast as I can. Mark sends us a comment that says, when we're spending more tax dollars and resources on broken families, doesn't that attack the problem from the wrong way? Is this a case where we need to make sure there aren't children born out of wedlock in the first place? I understand the point, but Dawn, that doesn't change the fact that there are children being born every day.
And I would say that's a very interesting point. It's where do you break that cycle?
Right.
And so in reality, when you take a very young mom who has struggled and then you're able to influence the trajectory of her child's life, we know that that child is far less likely to be incarcerated, to be abused, to be hospitalized for injury. They're going to arrive ready to learn, and that ready to learn means they'll succeed in school. So it really is the closest thing that we know, I believe, in terms of breaking that cycle.
Yeah. I might add just one more thing in terms of the findings that we have from both Elmira as well as in Memphis. And that is, yes, there is a first pregnancy, but the spacing of the children is greater for subsequent children and those that are nurse visited. So the mothers who are nurse visited are planning in terms of when to have their subsequent child in ways that allow them to not become overwhelmed with care. The first one to really provide more comprehensive care, and then in reality prevent exactly what you're talking about, unplanned pregnancies.
Yeah, I understand the chicken and egg question there, but I do think if you give young mothers help, and prevent bad outcomes, whether it's them getting into trouble, them losing a child, the child ending up unhealthy or in jail or dropping out of school. If you prevent those things, doesn't that prevent future single parents in trouble? So I know there's no perfect solution, whether you're funding it or creating programs. And I appreciate Mark's concern that he expressed.
But
it doesn't change the fact that today, right now, there's a child being born. And in some distress, in some trouble, in some risk, in poverty. And there's single mothers and pregnant women right now who probably need that help. All right, let's start to wrap our conversation with this then. On the research side of things, every researcher loves to have time, and it's really remarkable in this case to have had 20 years. Going forward, what happens next with research when it comes to these kind of interventions?
Well, one thing that we have been doing is we have been working very hard to take what we have learned and introduce that back into the field so the programs as they develop are developing with the evidence strong evidence that's behind that. We also have changed the entire field of child development and family life has changed, and as a result of that there are new pieces of the intervention that have been introduced over the last 20 years, and that is really to keep it current with the field, but also make certain that it is improved to the level of it's functioning at its maximum.
Yeah, and Dawn, for you and for United Way, what do you want the community to know about this program that will at least more awareness should help strengthen a program like this? What do you want people to know?
I think for us the most important thing is that A, it's made possible through generosity of people who give us donations to make it possible. And equally important that donation is doing what they most want to do when we talk to them. People want to make a difference. And what this tells us is they are making a difference in spades. And we are hoping that we can continue to support that program. We've since 2006, we've invested $2.6 million. We will be renewing funding, and our hope is to expand funding.
I am not, and I'm very, very careful about this because on this program, we and on WXXI in general, we talk to community causes and needs, et cetera. And, you know, to the best extent I can, I try to stay a neutral observer. So I'm not here telling you have to give the United Way or you have to give this charity or not. But it is absolutely, I think, vital for charities to be able to let people know that this is how your money is being used. And I know you're sensitive to that, Dawn. And this kind of a program is a good example of people being able to understand very, very clearly where it's going.
Absolutely.
And I imagine going forward that transparency is going to continue to be important.
Absolutely. And the evaluations are important to us. So we're thrilled to have the data, but equally important knowing that people should be hopefully inspired and encouraged, knowing that we do have some of the answers in this community.
Yeah, right.
We have some of the answers. We just need help getting that answer to more families in this community.
Not every program, not every idea works, and it's good to evaluate. If it doesn't work, you change it. But in this case, this kind of validation shows you what this early intervention, what the Nurse Family Partnership Program has been doing. And so, Dawn, thank you for sharing your perspective from the United Way. And Dr. Kitzman, really interesting research on a very, very important program. We hope we'll come back and talk to you as we continue to learn more about it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Shortest break in radio. I'm going to run, probably get myself out of breath, and I'll come back in here huffing and puffing, and we're actually talking Shakespeare next. Stay with us. Thursday on The Next Connections, it's our first Farmers Market Roundtable. This time of year, you can often find a community farmers market not far from where you live. Rochester's the big one, but many suburbs have their own, and there are plenty in the Finger Lakes. We'll find out what's happening at the markets. Then we'll explore children's music with performer Vincent Nunes. How has kids' music changed, and what value can it bring? It's coming up Thursday on Connections.
Now playing at the Little, Obvious Child tells the story of aspiring comedian Donna Stern, played by breakout actress Jenny Slate. Every day as a female 20-something provides material for her hysterical and relatable brand of humor. But when Donna winds up unexpectedly pregnant, she embarks on a hilarious and totally unplanned journey of self-discovery and empowerment. Huffington Post says Jenny Slate knocks this one out of the park, and in case it's not clear, is very, very funny. See details at thelittle.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and as I said, I huffed and puffed down the hall, and our guest huffed and puffed, and they're here. And I'm excited for this half hour to have a person who I consider a friend, but somebody who I think is one of the really fine character actors in Rochester in studio. That's Bill Alden, who has spent years in many, many productions of Shakespeare performances. And Bill, nice to have you here to talk a little Shakespeare.
Thanks, Evan.
Great to have you here.
Nice to see you actually doing some work for a change.
And I will not dignify that with a response. Dr. Luann Haggerty is here as well, and there's some big, speaking of Shakespeare, some big goings on.
Yes, very big.
Right now, what's going on, Dr. Haggerty?
Very large.
What's
a
going
large
on?
Cast.
Yes.
30 people doing A Midsummer Night's Dream in Highland Bowl Park. We have a simultaneously performed production in American Sign Language and in spoken English. And our exceptional actor over here, Bill Alden, plays the role of Bottom, and he also just won an acting award. I don't know if you know that.
Bill, do you want to explain?
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with Shakespeare. I've been lucky enough to be associated with the Rochester Community Players and the Rochester Shakespeare Players ostensibly in the last few years, and have just found them to be a marvelous organization. The things they do, Peter Scribner, president, doing a lot of innovative things with Shakespeare, which is what basically drew me into this. And then to fall into a completely unique, as far as Shakespeare is concerned, production with Luann in conjunction with NTID, and having the entire cast doubled with a person speaking the role and another person signing the same role at the same time on stage. It's been a very, very unique experience.
Yeah, a lot of times these types of shows are done where it's not actually simultaneously performed. It's interpreted. So you have a deaf actor who performs the role, and then you have a hearing actor who, just like a voiceover, does the role but doesn't really get to act it. Or the reverse. You have a fully hearing mainstream production, and you might get it interpreted or a few Band-Aid signers somewhere in the cast. But this is full out. We've broken down the cultures on the same reality planes that Shakespeare set up. So the fairy world uses the magic of sign language to communicate. And they have their own culture and language, and they're on stage all the time. In Shakespeare's script, they are not. But in our production, they influence everything all the time. The idea is you have, you may not know this, Evan, but you have a guardian fairy. You know when you can't find your keys? You know you put them down the first place you came in. You know, you come home, you put your keys down. 2 minutes later, you go to look, and they're gone. And you search for 20 minutes trying to find these keys, and if they end up being right where you left them, that is your fairy playing a joke on you. Fairies, unlike guardian angels, can be mischievous and tease you and play with you as well as
the mischievous fairies are my favorite kind. Well, it's a fabulous idea to do it that way. And frankly, in this community in Rochester, it's a little surprising that we don't – maybe we'll see more of it, although we haven't seen more of it.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. I mean, really, that was part of I greatly admire the Rochester Shakespeare Players and the Community Players. I interpret for them frequently, and their productions are always very high quality. The quality of talent we have in Rochester is far and away above any talent in any, you know, any pool of talent. I've worked in New York extensively, and I am an AEA equity member. I have Broadway credits, and I'm not just talking out of my hat here. The community actors in Rochester are of a very high quality, trained, committed, serious,
professional,
very professional.
I wouldn't have invited Bill if it were any other way.
Uh-huh.
And so again, if you're just joining us, the performance is presented every night between July 5th, so up until the 19th, which is, what's the day? The 9th is today? The 9th? You've got 11 more days.
Yep.
At the Highland Bowl, Midsummer Night's Dream.
We got flooded out last night.
But that's okay. Back on
schedule
now.
Fine, but the floods came.
So 8 p.m. At the bowl there, and donations solicited. But
it's amazing to me, this production with the fairies, the deaf actors actually being in the fairy world and at the same time as the human actors that we call. And you and I have spoken before about the depth of Shakespeare, and you know, when you actually delve into it, it's just incredible, beyond belief, the amount of depth that he put into it. And in this particular case, I found that the fairies, the idea of having fairies simultaneously interacting with you, it almost seems like it's written into the script. It almost seems as if Shakespeare intended it that way. And there's one instance where I'm going to explain to the rest of my compatriots what has happened. And the way Shakespeare writes it, all of a sudden, the character stops. He says, I'm going to tell you what happened. And then he just stops and he says, I'm not going to. Well, in this production, we have when I say, I'm going to tell you what happened, my fairy pushes my hat over my face. So it gives me an impetus to say, I'm not going to tell you what happened, which is written in the script, but it's almost as if he knew.
It's as seamless as it can be if you're altering Shakespeare in any way.
Well, Shakespeare is just so brilliantly adaptive.
Yeah, it's very easy, and it is a natural adaptation. It really is. In sign language, the word order, Shakespearean word order, the use of imagery, it translates beautifully, very easily. It's not a difficult translation at all.
Speaking of adaptive, I asked online, why has Shakespeare's popularity endured the way it has? And so many people said, adaptive. Janice writes to us, the language is beautiful, the texts are open to adaptation and multiple interpretations, the narrative's mythic. And then just to get under Bill Alden's skin, Janice says, also Stratford, which we're going to get to that in a minute, because I can't have Bill Alden in the room and not talk about Stratford versus Oxford. So we're going to get there in just a second. But let me at least establish this. As Luann has said, Bill Alden obviously has a good reputation, right?
Very good.
Bill, we know that reputation is an idol and most false imposition, oft got quote. Without merit and lost without deserving, isn't it?
He's going to quote Shakespeare.
To describe you. Has that ever been done?
That's
lofty.
Yes, very lofty. Too lofty for me.
But Bill, you also, I've known you for years to be a discerning actor, and you do not join productions if you don't appreciate the direction, the choices that are being made. What are some of the pitfalls that are out there that you have seen over the years that might put you off to the way Shakespeare can be produced?
Luann and I were talking a little bit before we came on the air here about Shakespeare and the depth of the characters is such that it whatever you want to bring to it, it's what you bring to it. And so if there's any failure in Shakespeare, I often think that it's better not to do Shakespeare at all than to do it badly, because then people will think that it is inherently bad. You know, you come out of high school and you're like, I never want to hear Shakespeare again as long as I live.
I think a lot of people do. That's right.
Absolutely, because of the treatment it gets. I think not to bash high schools, but I think what you need to do first and foremost, especially with adolescent minds in Shakespeare, is initiate them into the fun, the spontaneity, the curiosity, the humor of Shakespeare. And then, after they've matured a little bit, then you can introduce them into the iambic pentameter and the brilliance of the cosmic thinking of the thing. But first and foremost, it's fun.
First, yeah. It gets too heady. It gets too intellectual. And really, you know, you got to hit the groundlings. You got to hit the groundlings running. And with this production, you really have to be willing to go into a kinetic state almost. It's take in all of the visual and not worry about focusing in.
Well, I hope that in this one you will laugh.
Oh, yeah.
You will laugh. And I mean, that's, you know, you go to Shakespeare and you think, well, I'm supposed to do this now because this is supposed to be this type of a play and I'm supposed to appreciate it. But how many times have you gone to Shakespeare and actually laughed, just laughed like you would at a sitcom or whatever, a mindless thing? You think, oh, I'm at Shakespeare. That's not like that. But this will make you laugh.
People were screaming like it was a concert.
But what a fabulous point, though, because so many of us, our initiation to Shakespeare was having to learn the drudgery of some meter.
Absolutely.
As opposed to understanding the fact that there is pure fun, occasionally
Absolutely.
Pleasure, there's laughter, it can be dark, and understanding that kind of an approach, I'm not surprised that I look back at my high school Shakespeare days. And again, I had some wonderful teachers. This is not to malign all teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you approach it that way, and so many seem to, Shakespeare's DOA.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
and
it
you
becomes
do
literature.
Worse.
It's not dramatic anymore. It becomes literature.
And you do worse. You do a disservice because they never want to even approach it again. And, you know, a young kid.
They
says,
equate
no
Shakespeare
way. I
the
know
boy.
What Shakespeare is, and I'm not going anywhere near it.
Right.
Well, I was lucky enough when I was 17 years old to go to England and see at the Royal Shakespearean Theater a production of Julius Caesar, which happened to star at that time Patrick Stewart and I believe Ian McKellen was in it. They were no one at that time. I didn't know, you know, who they were. And I knew nothing about it, but I just went in there as a kid, an 18-year-old kid, and saw this production, and it blew me away. It blew me away. It was nothing like what I had experienced in high school. Nothing. I understood every word. It was just as powerful as any movie could be. And I came out of there thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to do Shakespeare like that so that people know what it is like.
But Joseph Papp's, you know, philosophy of making sure that there's free Shakespeare in the park so that it doesn't matter that you don't have a ticket price, you still get a high-quality production. Patrick Stewart was in a production in Shakespeare in the Park where it was after he was on Star Trek. So the audience was a mix of Trekkies and very Shakespearean scholarly types. So it was an interesting mix and diversity in the audience. And that's something I know I really consciously tried to do in the direction, in the casting. We have an extremely diverse cast in age. We've got kids. We've got older people. We've got women playing men's parts occasionally. We have all sorts of ethnicities flying around stage.
Yeah.
And deaf and hearing. I mean, that's an obvious diversity.
Which, Midsummer Night's Dream, that's what it's bent to. I mean, it's between the fairy world and the real world. And Shakespeare was just having fun.
And it should be us. It should represent us, really, all of us, not just Shakespeare's British.
I'm going to get to the phones in just a second. If you want to join the conversation on what you love about Shakespeare, or did you also grow up, like many of us, maybe dreading Shakespeare until did you have an epiphany with Shakespeare? Was there one performance? Bill talked about that remarkable performance he saw that changed him. Love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or right here in Rochester, 263 WXXI, 263-9994. Here's someone our guests might know. It's Peter in Rochester. Go ahead, Peter.
Peter.
Hi, I'm the president of the Rochester Community Players, the organization that's staging this production. I'm delighted to hear Bill and Luann on there.
First, a
quick correction. We're on every night except Mondays and Thursdays between now and July 19th.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
Thursday night, the Parks Department runs movies at the Bowl, which is kind of a fun event as well. Also, I heard Bill kind of finesse to the question of this award that he received earlier this spring. Besides our Shakespeare production or program, the Rochester Community Players also has an Irish theater program. And we put on a production in the springtime, which we then take on the road to something called the Acting Irish International Theater Festival.
Hey, sure we do.
And I wish your accent was that good. Anyway, I'm just funny, and I love Bill. Anyway, so the festival was in Delray Beach, Florida this year, which was a wonderful place to have a theater fest. And there were nine productions there, or eight productions, and there are many really excellent productions. And from all that, Bill got the Best Supporting Actor Award from the festival. And rightly so. He did just a brilliant job. I had an opportunity to direct Bill as Brutus in a production of Julius Caesar last fall. So in the past, 9 months, he's gone from Brutus to a modern Irish play to playing the comic role of Bottom. And then this coming fall, you know, he's playing Gloucester in our production of King Lear. So
can't get enough Shakespeare.
He's an amazing actor, and we're very happy to have him with our
team. Well, when Peter did the directed Julius Caesar last fall, his idea for it was what is known as original practices, which the idea of it is to have the actors and the audience experience what a Shakespearean play in Elizabethan times would have been like, on a thrust stage with the audience right in your face and actually interacting with the audience. We walked the characters when they did their soliloquies, actually did them to the various audience members, which was, I found, an incredible experience. I thought it worked beautifully with Shakespeare, and in fact,
we do that in this production too. The books come right into the audience. You may be surprised if you come and see the show. They'll pop up right behind you, run right past you. They'll eat your popcorn, your watermelon, whatever you got.
not in an obnoxious way. I mean, some people go, I don't want somebody coming up to me and, you know, handing me flowers or whatever. And it's like, it's not an obnoxious way. It just connects you in a visceral sense to what's going on. They don't come up to anybody and embarrass them or drag anybody into the, you know.
Well, Peter, thank you for calling in. Thanks for the nice words about Bill. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say also that Luann is doing a wonderful job. I don't know if it's made clear here, but this simultaneously voiced and signed production of Shakespeare, as far as I can tell, and I've researched it, has never been done by a regular Shakespeare company before, like ever.
Yay.
And so I think it's an amazing salute to Rochester that we have the resources here that we're able to pull that off.
I agree. I think that's a great point, Peter. And as I said, a little bit surprising given our community here that it hasn't been done, but what a great innovation, and I suspect see much more.
New tradition.
Peter, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And Peter, I'm glad Peter, again, brought up Bill's award. It makes me think perhaps I should say, oh, let me kiss that hand. But you know what? I'd probably think better of it, and I'd probably say, let me wipe it first. It smells of mortality.
So instead of doing research on your two guests on the internet,
I just decided to read.
You flashed a couple of Shakespearean quotes and said, oh, this will work. I can work this in.
No, I've been, unfortunately, I've just been reading Shakespeare. I said, you know, instead of just actually preparing for the show, I got sidetracked, Bill. Now,
it's easy to do.
But we had a question online from Patrick who said that interesting comments about high school students. Shouldn't we change the language to make it more modern so they can understand
it? No.
They can understand
absolutely
it.
Absolutely not. No, the whole thing about Shakespeare is the language. The language is what it's about. And I, you know, a lot of people that I discuss Shakespeare with that are turned off by it will say, oh, it's, you know, they're speaking a different language. My father, they're speaking a different language, Bill. They're speaking a different language. I said, Dad, they're not speaking a different language. It's English. It's just words that we don't use very often, and we are lazy. We don't want to take the time to think about what does that word mean, you know?
The other thing, too, is beyond everyday language, something magical happens when you create a language that's specific for stage. And in Shakespearean language, you have the beauty of the literature, the poetics, and how naturally and nicely it fits in your mouth. It feels good to say it. And I think what happens is when you're reading, cold reading Shakespeare, or even just reading sections out loud and you don't really know what it means, it is very hard to make sense of it. So it almost has to be flipped where somebody, the teacher or someone comes in to the class and at least reads a part in a way that makes sense, you know, because it's not a cold reading. It's actually prepared. And once the students hear it and can see, oh, I totally know what that means. Will be more...
The interpretation.
Yeah, they'll
the
be
interpretation
more into digging
is key.
And finding it.
And that's what struck me about it when I saw that play many, many years ago in England, was what the actors did was what made it unbelievable. It took words from a page and brought them to life in a way that I didn't think was possible. And as Luann says, it's such a beautiful language. It's such a, you know, getting back to the viewer's comment about I consider that dumbing it down for students nowadays. No, I don't think so at all. I don't think so. I think that it is for us to realize that these things are considered great for a reason, and that if they don't seem great to us, the failing is not in the words, but in ourselves.
I couldn't agree more. Go ahead.
To that end, I would say the side-by-side, you know, texts do help. You need a stepping stone, perhaps, to get to a place where you can make something that's unfamiliar to you familiar. So if you can seed it in something that's your own experience and then build on it, it has the intensity and the resonance of your own thoughts, your own feelings, your own experiences. So there's nothing wrong with using modern language as a stepping stone to get there, but don't stop. Let them really feel it.
And talking about dual dual dialogue, this script that Luann gave us for this play was like, no, I mean, I've been acting for 40 years. I've never seen a script like this my entire life. The Shakespeare was on one side of the page, and on the other side were...
A gloss, a first step in the translation of American Sign Language. So American Sign Language is a three-dimensional language. You can't really put it on paper, but you can put the word order, and you can put down English equivalents. So it looks terrible, and it is just a first step because you don't have the facial expression, body language, references, locations that you would use in a full translation. But it gives you like a skeleton, a structure to move.
But for an actor to look at a page, and on one side, you know, I'm quoting Shakespeare, and on the other side, it's saying, squeeze flower down, feel ugly, look back, whatever. It's just very, very, very strange. Very interesting. But Troy, my counterpart, who's playing Bottom in the deaf community, the fairy community, that's the script he uses. And it's right next to mine. So it's been a unique, very unique experience.
Back to the phones. This is Noel in Rochester. Thanks for calling, Noel.
Hey there. Yeah. Sadly, we don't have Patrick Stewart with Star Trek Next Generation and some of the other classic Shakespearean actors on TV providing the transition. With my two sons, we grew up on Star Trek, and my oldest son, bless his heart, when Patrick Stewart came to Manhattan to do the Christmas Carol all by himself, specifically asked to go to hear Patrick Stewart do Dickens because he was so much in love with his ability to do the language the way he does.
Yeah. Yes.
We have some exceptional actors here, though. They're just not necessarily known. I mean, Patrick Stewart has a big name.
And, of course, it's all accessible on DVDs and the Internet and everything. I mean, I just purchased and watched Richard Burton's production of Hamlet that was on stage in New York City in 1964. And somebody filmed it, and they put it on a DVD. So you can watch that. And if you think there's anything better... if you don't think there's anything better than Richard Burton doing Hamlet with Hume Croynan as Polonius, I don't know. You know, doesn't get any better than that.
Well, I appreciate it, Noel. Let's grab Thomas. Thanks for calling, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hey, Luann, it's Thomas Warfield.
Hey, Luann. Thomas.
This production, I saw it on opening night, and it was spectacular. And what I wanted to say about it was accessible on so many levels, the diversity level, hearing and deaf. You know, languages, the beauty of languages is the rhythm of languages. And what happens in the performance of Shakespeare like this is that it brings that rhythm into a physicality. And that's what makes it so compelling to anyone. I mean, you don't have to really even understand what exactly is going on all the time, but you sort of... kinetically connect with the story through this sort of body or nonverbal communication. And that's what's so marvelous about this production. You know, the other one last thought I wanted to say is that, you know, at NTID, we've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
I feel so wonderful that it's finally out there in the public to see it, you know, in a broader sense. But Luann has really directed some marvelous Shakespearean things and other people at NTID with this dual idea of languages. So bravo to all of you for doing such a wonderful job and giving this community such a wonderful diversity.
It means a great deal.
Thomas, thank you. Great call. I appreciate that. And maybe we'll start to wrap with this. I'd like to do a little bit of a PSA on behalf of Bill Alden. It's always worth knowing.
He likes you.
I met Bill years ago, and Bill turned me on to the question of Oxfordian versus Stratfordian, and we could do an hour on this, and I suspect we will on this program, because I am fascinated by the question. But it is always worth, when you're appreciating Shakespeare, you know, every year we get the Bard's birthday and all this stuff, and it probably drives Bill nuts, doesn't it? It does, doesn't it?
Because
Bill is an Oxfordian.
I performed at the 450th anniversary of the birth of the man from Stratford, and I
who
was
you
magnanimous.
Think was a dunce. You think he was a dunce.
Why would you frame it that way? He was what he was.
He wasn't what you think he was, but he was what he was.
He was a human being in his times, making his way through life just like everybody else.
And he wasn't the one who wrote these plays, you
No,
say.
I don't think so.
And that would have been Edward de Vere, you think?
I believe so. I think Edward de Vere, the more I've researched it for a number of years now, read numerous books on it, and the more I research it, the more his life fits perfectly into what one would think would be the type of person who would write about kings and queens and royal entanglements.
And travel to Italy.
And
you have to have somebody who knows how to get down into the roots, how to get down into the real emotions. And
see, here comes Dr. Haggerty hitting you back, Bill.
The earthiness of it, the bodiness of it.
You're not buying it, are you, Dr. Haggerty?
No. I think Shakespeare.
Well, the PSA.
In the final analysis, it makes no difference whatsoever to the performer,
right. We have
to the director. The only difference it makes is personally. It allows you a more intimate connection. However you can connect to these works,
That's the most gracious thing I've ever heard you say about this debate, by the way.
I think it's absolutely true.
And the PS,
there's too much yelling.
Well,
there's too much yelling and screaming and animosity about it. There's no need to be.
You're all grown up, Bill.
There's no need to be.
And the PSA, though, is that if you don't know who Edward de Vere is, at least look it up and read.
Shakespeare by another name, Mark Anderson.
There you go. So have fun with it. Read, check it out. But in the meantime, you've got a wonderful opportunity to see the Shakespeare Players Program, the Rochester Community Players performing A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Bowl through July 19th.
Do come.
And Dr. Haggerty, what a wonderful
fusion. Bring a bottle
of
wine, a good friend, sit down, a blanket maybe.
Let the fireflies sparkle and the stars sparkle and our stars on stage sparkle.
And you get to hear Bill's rich, mellifluous baritone there.
You'll laugh.
You will laugh, definitely.
All right, somebody cut his mic. He's out of my show enough. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Dr. Haggerty. Great to see you. And thanks to our listeners for joining the conversation today. Thanks to Dave Campo, our engineer behind the glass. I'm Evan Dawson. You've been listening to Member Supported Public Radio.